Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sitting here reading Rob Prince on Foreign Policy and Focus. He's going to be on the show later. I should have finished this article by now. Try to catch up during breaks. I know the first half of the story. But don't we need an update on the Western war in Mali? I have decided that yes, we do. So that's happening. And then our good friend Sheldon Richmond's going to be on the show. Talk about Iran and America's Iran policy. You know, I should write in my notes here to ask Rob about Somalia too, because he's great on Somalia. And one of my problems is that hardly anybody's any good on Somalia, you know? But it's such an important story, America's war in Somalia. Try to cover it whenever I can. And Rob Prince, I know he can just go off the top of his head and explain what the hell about that. So, seems to me important for me to ask him. Pardon the dead air, I'm spacing out as I write the date on my notepad. I really wanted to interview Patrick Coburn about his Syria thing. And then I thought, you know what? Maybe I'm starting to bother Patrick Coburn, having him on too often. Or maybe he's just busy. He always seems happy to do the show, you know. I just don't want to wear it out. I think I'm going to give him a couple of days. But yeah, Patrick, man, he wrote this thing about Syria that, well, we may just talk about. I mentioned it the other day. It's Britain's Syria policy falls apart, something like that. The West, you might as well have said America's, but he's writing for a British audience. But, yeah, I need a good detailed who's who and who's fighting for what on the ground in Syria. I think David Enders finally got smart and left that place before it was too late for him. Guy was kidnapped by the al-Nusra Front. And then they let him go. Can you believe that? Now, McClatchy's got a guy named Mitchell Protheroe writing over there. I don't know much about him, but he's been writing some really good stuff. Of course, one of their reporters, Austin Tice, one of their first reporters into Syria, has been held, presumably, I guess, by the government this whole time. All indications are, at least last I heard, that he's still alive and I don't think he's being held for ransom. He's just being held. It's a dangerous war to be in as a journalist over there in Syria. Past few years there. But anyway, Patrick Coburn, he goes. That guy, he'll go right into a war zone. Well, you know, hang a jacket up in the window, he says. That way they can't see you too well. Do all right. Hope I didn't just give him away. Anyway, see if I can get Patrick on the show later in the week for you. But we'll probably cover some Syria on the show today anyway. Let me hit refresh on antiwar.com just in case something really important blew up right before I went on the air here that I need to know about. That looks good. So, I want to start, I guess, with some NSA stuff. First of all, I think this got a mention on the show yesterday. No, maybe not. Anyway, I sure would recommend that you go and look at this. It's by Andy Greenberg in Forbes, and he does a lot of really great stuff, journalism, I mean, about technology issues and stuff. Andy Greenberg over there at Forbes.com. And this one is, an NSA co-worker remembers the real Edward Snowden, a genius among geniuses. And This is credible to me. I saw some people saying, oh, yeah, claims this and that and whatever. But, well, in my opinion, Annie Greenberg has earned the benefit of the doubt as far as his journalism goes. And he says here that all these details he got, he actually checked them with Edward Snowden's lawyer, his ACLU lawyer, to see if he could verify them. And it all checked out. So it seems to me like the person talking to Annie Greenberg here would have to be telling the truth to even know what this person claims to know. Would have to be telling the truth that this person actually does work for the NSA. And I guess I'll just cut to the chase here because, you know, there's a lot of information here. I guess I'll go through it. But I want to go ahead and skip to the end, which is, I was shocked and betrayed when I first learned the news about Ed Snowden talking to Greenwald, leaking the documents. But as more time passes, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Sorry for the rough start this morning, or this afternoon, whatever, you know. Strange clicking sounds, and my broadband connection broke right before airtime. It was one of those for no reasons kind of things. So I unplugged it and I replugged it and that didn't work. So I unplugged it and replugged it again and it worked. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if it's science or what, but something hardware or software-y. These things happen. I guess what I could do is I could have a separate internet connection. And just pay double for my internet and have some kind of fancy backup where it just clicks from, you know, AT&T over to Time Warner. Is that possible to do? Is that worth the expense? I guess the AT&T doesn't fail that often. Usually not right before airtime. You know. But anyway, all right. So I'm Scott. This is the show. The Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Express Radio. Charles Goyette's coming up. Those of you who are regular listeners to the Liberty Express, well, you hear Charles all the time on Alan's show. But, you know, I need to start listening to Alan's show in the morning more often and listen to Charles. I've read Charles's books, and I've talked to him at length over the years, but I guess I'm really not that familiar with what he has to say to other people all the time. I'll try to ask overly broad questions, and then we'll just see what Charles has to say. Charles Goyette, author of The Dollar Meltdown and Red, Blue, and Broke All Over. That's coming up on the show. I saw some headlines. I almost broke into monetary policy on the show yesterday, but I decided to stick with the NSA. Hey, someone turn my compressor all the way up or something? It seems like something's wrong with this signal. Check! Hello! Hey! So if I yell, it's nice and loud, but if I talk normally, man, it's turning me way, way down, it seems like. I mean, according to the blobs in the recorder program. Let me see. What's the ratio on this thing? Check! Check! Oh, it is this one, right? Yeah. I'm going to turn that down a little bit there and see what happens. All right. Well, anyway. So that's me messing around with my equipment. Coming up on the show, other than Charles Goyette, also Trita Parsi will be on the show today. Trita Parsi from the National Iranian American Council. And he'll be on, of course, in support of the nuclear deal and what else the U.S. state can do to make the Iranian regime the kind of regime that the American regime can more easily deal with. How to come about, how to help bring about mutually beneficent exchanges between our two countries. Good times. It sounds kind of boring, but it's not. And in fact, it gives me an opportunity to get right into Iran on the show today. Something that I want to talk about anyway, and I won't have time to cover all this in the conversation with Trita. So, first of all, what I want to say is that there's a new poll out, and I admit I got this from the Democrats, but I think they just linked to it. And it's, new poll provides more evidence that Americans support the Iran deal. You might have heard that the polls say that the people don't like it. Yeah, well, those are the rigged polls pushed by the Republicans. But at thinkprogress.org, they have a link here to an Associated Press poll, a new one. Has found that a majority of Americans support the first step agreement reached last month between the six world powers and Iran over its nuclear program. The deal freezes Iran's production of low-enriched uranium, eliminates its stockpile of higher-enriched uranium, and commits the Islamic Republic to more intrusive inspections from United Nations nuclear experts in exchange for modest sanctions relief. A new AP GFK poll found that 59% either approve or lean approve, while 38% disapprove or lean disapprove. These results track with a number of surveys taken recently. All that's hot linked over to the source material on the Iran nuclear deal and serve as further evidence that the two recent polls, one conducted by Pew and the other by a Republican pollster finding opposition to the agreement, are outliers. The AP GFK poll results, and you know how this works, it's usually not bad science as far as how many people you need to ask in order to, you know, figure out the percentages that people are answering with. It's all in the question. It's all in the premise of the question, usually unstated. And so, anybody can write a poll question to say anything and to, you know, lead the witness, like on Perry Mason. Get them to say something that they weren't necessarily about to say, but by rigging the circumstances in which they're opinioning. Anyway, and it doesn't even have to be deliberate, right? It can just be the honest, mistaken, or incomplete assumptions of the question authors. Just because they're doing their best, and their best isn't enough. But anyway, moreover, the bill says, they're talking about the bill. We're going to get to that in a second. So, there you go. What the American people want, they quote, who's this? Carl Levin. Saying the American people want and expect a peaceful resolution. Now, they have to sort of leave out peaceful resolution to what there? Because, of course, there is no crisis. It is the entire Iranian nuclear program is only a manufactured crisis, as Gareth Porter puts it. It's a crisis to be diffused on this end, on the United States end. It's nothing the Iranians have done, not really. But the Americans and the Israelis are constantly threatening to escalate their demands that Iran give up their entire nuclear program or else face attack. So that's the crisis that needs defusing, is the endless American and Israeli threats. And, but so anyway, the American people support this. And the polls have also shown that when asked, well, what if the talks fail? They say, well, then come up with some more talks. They still don't want a war. Not another war over in the Middle East. You don't have to know where Iran is to know that you don't want to go die there over some nonsense just like last time and the time before that. And then that brings us to Jim Loeb's blog, loeblog.com. The Kirk Menendez-Schumer Wag the Dog Act of 2014, he calls it. And this is about the Democrats' legislation in the Senate. The Democrats control the Senate, of course, to pass this Sense of Congress resolution. Well, first of all, I mean, it calls it the... I don't know exactly what kind of resolution they're calling it. It's new sanctions. It's the Iran Nuclear Weapon Free Act of 2013. And as Jim Loeb points out, it says, it's interesting the way they set this up. Interesting in a slow motion train wreck kind of a way. It's a sanctions bill, and it requires that any final agreement, including the dismantling of all Iran's enrichment capabilities, a condition which Iran has made clear repeatedly, is a non-starter. I didn't state that right. I skipped a word in there somewhere. It requires that any final agreement include the dismantling of every last bit of Iran's enrichment capabilities. So in other words, it's the ultimate poison pill. It's not just sanctions, but it's trying to tie the hands of the president that he can negotiate nothing less than an end to the fuel cycle, which is, of course, not meant to make sure that Obama gets that. It's meant to just kill the deal. The senators know they can't have that. And it also expresses a sense of the Congress that America, and then isn't this interesting, the slang here? America will have Israel's back. That's the quote. America will have Israel's back if Israel acts in self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapons program. Huh? Jim Loeb writes, mind you, not against an actual or imminent attack, but against, quote, Iran's nuclear weapons program, which, as far as the sponsors of this bill are concerned, at least as far as their false premise is concerned, they already have. So America will, quote, have Israel's back if Israel acts. That means initiates force. Starts an aggressive war. If Israel decides to launch a war, then America shall be bound to follow Israel. To let Prime Minister Netanyahu decide whether to take America to war or not. And then just lies in the most ridiculous comic book fashion in just simple Orwellian doublespeak. Not even Orwellian doublespeak, just plain dishonesty. That if Israel launches this attack, that will be somehow, by definition, an act of self-defense by them. What, just because it's by Israel? And any aggression that they commit is defense because they say so, or because Democrats say so? Huh? Yeah, aggression is aggression. Self-defense is self-defense, see? And then, of course, the lie that if Israel attacks, that America should help Israel attack, and that would be self-defense, that attack would be self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapons program, which they don't even bother trying to insult our intelligence with an argument that such a thing even exists. They just assert it and move on. You know, because if they try to say, well, yeah, what's going on at Natanz is a nuclear weapons program, or what's going on at Bushehr is a nuclear weapons program, or what's going on at Fordo is a nuclear weapons program, well, then you can specifically refute those assertions. But you could just skip all the argument by just asserting, oh, yeah, a nuclear weapons program, as though every bit of nuclear anything anywhere in the country is all somehow part of what, I don't know, will be someday a nuclear weapons program? Not sure. And then Jim seems to think, Jim Loeb, again, I'm reading loeblog.com. Jim seems to think that they're very clear here that if Israel starts the war, then the U.S. government should stand with Israel and provide, in accordance with the law and the constitutional responsibility of Congress to authorize the use of military force, etc., etc., in order to support the government of Israel, capital G, government of Israel, in its defense of its territory, people, and existence. Again, with aggression being coined defense. But anyway, so Jim says, well, Congress at least will have to approve an authorization to use military force. But I think that language is weasel word enough that certainly we would at least hear people try in the future, if Israel ever did start the war, we would hear attempts of their partisans to pretend that this was the authorization to use military force. That, of course, that's what it means when it invokes and says the U.S. government should stand with Israel in accordance with the law and the constitutional responsibility of Congress to authorize the use of military force. You vote for that. You vote for that. That's what they're going to try to say. Just like they tried to say they didn't need a second resolution in the U.N. in 2003, right? Just like Hillary Clinton tries to say her vote to let George Bush go to war in Iraq was no such thing at all, but merely the authorization for him to do so if he decided to do so, which was really her just trying to give him an extra bargaining chip to use. She never thought he would use it. Same for Vice President Biden. Would have been the same for Obama had he been in the U.S. Senate at the time, too. But anyway. And then Jim Loeb goes on to point out that Senator Kirk was the biggest recipient of pro-Israel PAC money in Congress since 2002. In his most recent campaign, Menendez received more than $340,000 from pro-Israel PACs, beating out all other Senate candidates. Schumer, Schumer, a major rainmaker for other Democratic candidates, ranked fifth in his 2010 race at more than $260,000, far behind Kirk, the year's winner, at nearly $640,000. Let there be no doubt about it, Jim Loeb writes, this bill was approved by AIPAC and is thus as close to the position of the Israeli government as its followers here believe would be politically palatable. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Charles Goyette's coming up. And then Trita Parsi from the National Iranian American Council. Talk about how to better secure the peace with Iran, if that's possible. And so now I want to pick up with where Jim Loeb left off here. The Kirk Menendez Schumer Wag the Dog Act of 2014 is the title at loeblog.com. It's actually in the top headlines at antiwar.com today as well under the headline, The Dangerous Kirk Menendez Schumer Iran Bill. And it is surely dangerous. It's meant to destroy the talks. That's it. It's as simple as that. Come on. We supposed to believe any of these people think that what? They're like the Hillary Clinton excuse, what she was doing for George Bush, just giving him a real threat to swing around but not really use. That's what they're doing for Obama here. When he's not asking for that, he sent Senator Kerry, the Secretary of State, to go tell his former colleagues, hey man, would you back off a little bit, please, while we're trying to do this? And, you know, we talked about this a little bit with Sheldon on the show yesterday about how Obama went to the Sabin Center. That's Haim Sabin, who's a zillionaire because of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and who gave a ton of money to the Brookings Institution, which is sort of the centrist Democrats, to make sure that, you know, anything liberal and human rightsy about them that might push them or you know, lead them to lean the slightest bit toward the Palestinians will always be overridden by their salaries. And they created the Sabin Center there at Brookings to be, you know, just AIPAC left is all. And Obama had to go there, and Sheldon rightly criticized him for saying, look, guys, you know, I think probably this is going to, you know, at best we have a 50-50 chance of maybe working this out. That's all he was trying to sell them, a 50-50 chance. Basically, what he was selling them was, come on, I'm Obama. You like me, liberal types. You trust me. I wouldn't be doing this if it was going to be bad for Israel. I really think this is going to work out. Or I think that, you know, if we got a deal, the kind of deal that I'm looking to get, that it would be okay. So give me a little bit of breathing room, would you? That's basically all he was doing, right? He wasn't selling them on the deal itself, that the deal itself would be great, just that he means well, that they can trust him to go ahead and continue on, which is craven and horrifying, but in effect, I doubt he meant this, but in effect, it's kind of brilliant, too. I mean, not like anybody else in America seems to care is paying that much attention. Certainly, the media isn't going to portray it this way. But what he's saying is, hey, listen, Israel's fifth column in America. The people want this. Commander-in-chief, the head of state, he's trying to pursue peace. And hey, look, America, the only people standing in the way are those who put the interests of Israel first. So why don't you guys quiet down a little bit? Now, I mean, that's actually a really optimistic spin on it, right? That it has, that it can would convey that meaning to anyone else. But he didn't have to go give that talk to the log cabin Republicans, and he didn't have to go give that talk to your local bowling league, and he didn't have to go give that talk to the Council on Foreign Relations. He went and he gave that talk to the Sabin Center. Now, other than, you know, Eric Edelman and Bill Kristol, the Council on Foreign Relations are the people that we would typically identify with the Council on Foreign Relations. They're for this thing. That's a headline at Loblog right now. Scowcroft, Brzezinski urge Iran accord. And Kissinger as well. Those are what counts for CFR wise men in America these days. And they want this thing. I mean, not that their statements aren't full of whatever, you know, caveats and will to bloodletting and whatever, but in effect, I think Obama's calling out the Israel lobby in the United States that, hey, listen, this could be a major step toward peace. Why don't you please quit obstructing me a little? And then, of course, we've seen how that's worthless. I agree with Phil Giraldi, and I know it makes me a hypocrite, I guess, because I'm a Lysander Spoonerite, but not really a hypocrite, because, see, Spooner's whole argument was, I never owed you any allegiance in the first place, so how could I possibly be guilty of treason? But in this case, Phil Giraldi, he's talking about members of Congress. And they most certainly do owe allegiance, at least to the country, if not to the state. They certainly are betrayers of the Constitution. And what's cool is, you know, Giraldi is very careful here, and he talks about how the constitutional definition of treason is very specific, and the bar is very high. And so, geez, do we really quite have the right name for it? Well, maybe in a legal sense, we don't. But in a dictionary definition sense, these congressmen, these senators who are trying to obstruct this nuclear deal with Iran, they're traitors. They're acting as agents of a foreign power, attempting to prevent the American president from negotiating a peace with a country at whom with whom we've been engaged in a Cold War for 34 years. Almost 35. And there's just no secret or question about why it is they do what they do and whose interests that they're representing. And Phil Giraldi does a great case. It's in his article, Some Might Call It Treason, today at antiwar.com. Here he quotes neocon Noam Neusner, recently provided an insight into what is going on in Congress, boasting that, quote, normally a party's leadership, never mind the opposition party, right? The president's own party. Normally a party's leadership will stand behind a president, hell, even the other guys too, will stand behind a president in his moment of diplomatic achievement. Not this time. He further explains that the conspicuous silence among Democrats is because they are the men and the women, after all, who were on a first-name basis with most of the board of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And they want to be in Washington long after Obama leaves the White House. Unless there be any confusion about what AIPAC and the rest of the lobby want, Abe Foxman in the Anti-Defamation League has offered his own critique, saying that he is, quote, embarrassed by our government's acceptance of Iran's blackmail, calling secret talks with Iran a violation of the special relationship with Israel. The pressure's been so intense, Obama had to go to the Sabin Center, et cetera, et cetera. Go read it yourself. And tell me, I mean, I don't even think Lockheed is in on this one. As far as I know, I'm not trying to acquit him, but somebody show me anyone but the American Israelis trying to obstruct this deal right now. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In the war state, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show here on Liberty Express, 3 to 5 Eastern. You guys are used to hearing Charles Goyette on Alan Butler's show. But we like to talk to our old friend Charles from Anti-War Radio Days every once in a while when we can. Hey, Charles, how's things?
Scott, it's great to talk to you. Things are great.
Good, good. Happy to have you here. Man, does everybody's phone sound terrible, or is it something broken here? I was pretty sure it was everybody else's fault but mine, but now I'm starting to wonder. Anyway.
Well, this phone should sound great.
All right, well. We're gonna see what happens. So, Charles, you wrote some books. One of them is big and yellow and has a melting dollar on the front, and it's really easy to recognize at the Christmas shopping store. It's called The Dollar Meltdown, and it's really good and fun to read. And then also there's another one, too, which isn't quite as fun to read. Because it's even worse about how bad things really are. I mean, it's good on how bad things really are is what I'm trying to say there. So that's red and blue and broke all over the trouble the American government has got the American country into or something like that. I forgot the title. Red and blue and broke all over. So everybody ought to go and spend as much money as they can getting the most expensive copy they can from their favorite local bookseller, The Dollar Meltdown, and Red and Blue and Broke All Over, and check out Charles' website, charlesgoyette.com. So, I'm glad I got a chance to say that, because I really like those books a lot, and I really do want people to read them, and also to pay you.
Well, that's very generous of you. You're really in the Christmas spirit.
Yeah. So, everyone, obey my commands and follow my influence. All right. Now, so let me ask you this. I saw on the TV yesterday, and they said that the central bank has decided that they've done a great job, and now it's time to go ahead and back off all of their monetary stimulus and all of their 85-something billion dollars a month worth of securities they've been buying, and they're going to start tapering, I mean, slowly backing off the amount of new money that they're inflating. And so I guess you and all the free market guys were proven wrong, and interventionism works great, and we're living the good times right now because of it, because that's what they said on CNN.
Well, I suppose that's one way to put it, and I'm not surprised you would find it put that way in the national news media. This thing has been an absolute debacle. It's been, I don't take any particular delight. To me, it's not personal. I don't take any particular delight in the in Ben Bernanke leaving the Fed next month, because he's going to be replaced with somebody who, you know, worships at the same temple and has the same, you know, Keynesian spend your way to prosperity, primitive superstitious beliefs. So, but he has been an absolute calamity if you think about it. You know, this may get a little technical for people, but when Ben Bernanke came in the door, took the helm of the Federal Reserve, the monetary base, the balance sheet of the Fed was just a little over $800 billion. That was in 2005. He's walking out the door now. The balance sheet of the Fed as he leaves will be almost eight times as large. Almost, we're talking about $4 trillion. So what happened? Well, the Fed basically created out of thin air during Ben Bernanke's reign with the monetary base beginning at about $800 billion, it just spiked. It was a hockey stick curve that went straight up, and it doubled. And it doubled again, and now it's growing again. So it has quintupled during his tenure. And this all represents money that was just made up out of thin air. It was money that was just printed the morning before in the basement of the Mariner Eccles building in Washington, D.C. It's just a few electrons spinning around in cyberspace by the keystroke someplace that created trillions of dollars of new U.S. dollars out of nothing. And what did they use the money for? Well, they used the money to buy the downgraded debt of the United States Treasury. And they used the money to buy, you know, toxic securities, mortgage-backed securities, toxic paper that the major money center banks had gotten into trouble buying. And so the Fed printed up a bunch of money to reliquify the banks, to take those toxic, worthless mortgage securities off the balance sheet of the banks and put them onto the balance sheet of the American people, basically on the balance sheet of the U.S. dollar. So we have seen the most incredible eruption of monetary printing in modern history during the reign of Ben Bernanke. And now as he goes out the door, he says, oh, but don't worry, situation normal, everything out of control. And beginning next month, instead of printing a little over $1 trillion a year, we're only going to print $900 billion a year. Hello? And so here's the way I look at it. If you project where we will be this time next year, December of 2014, the monetary of the base, because of this brave decision that they've made to taper this week, the monetary base of the United States at the end of this time next year, at the end of 2014, instead of being $5 trillion, will only be $4.9 trillion. What a brave move they have made. Clearly, Scott, the trajectory of money printing remains alarmingly steep. It remains virtually the same. And why shouldn't it? Because, frankly, we haven't had to pay much of a price for it so far.
Well,
so far.
Now, it seems like, if I remember right, back in, say, late summer, or really, I guess, all through the summer, I'm not sure exactly when it started. But anyway, summer, certainly sometime in summer of 2008, I remember reading over at LouRockwell.com about how, they're deflating. They're beginning to raise the overnight rates and all that. They've gotten spooked. They're afraid that they've built the bubble up too much, and so now they're trying to let the air out, but you know what always happens. And then there's the Rothbard quote about how you can't let the air out slow. It always pops. And I think that's from America's Great Depression. But anyway, so then that was what happened. Just at the end of September, the bubble popped, and it seemed like, it seems like Bernanke's learned that lesson, sort of. Again, shades, somehow this keeps coming up on the show, Lyndon Johnson saying, well, I'm not going to be the first president to lose a war, so I'm just going to make Nixon lose it years from now, and just, who cares about all the people who die between now and then. I think Bernanke's learned the lesson that that's the last time he tries to scale back anything very much anyway. He's got to keep the pedal to the metal at least until he can pass it off onto the next schmuck, where he was Greenspan's schmuck who had to take the hit for the giant Greenspan bubble, or the second giant Greenspan bubble. He's going to make this Yellen or whoever's after her take the hit for him, huh?
Yeah, I think as a matter of fact, it's probably pretty shrewd of him to get out now. I'm fairly certain he was shown the door. Effectively, it was let known that he wasn't going to be reappointed, and it was all done very gracefully. But I think he's got, I wouldn't want to be chairman of the Fed with what they've got coming. And so they put the utterly clueless Janet Yellen in there, and she's been a factotum of big government. Big fiat money, big money printing, big quantitative easing, big Keynesian nonsense all of her professional life. So I said, fine, let her take the hit.
Well, although, I mean, I don't know. Can they just keep inflating and inflating? I mean, it seemed like in the last giant bubble, it didn't really turn around until Bernanke got spooked and made it turn around. Like, if he had just kept inflating, would we still be in the housing bubble from then?
If he had not slowed it back? I can't tell you exactly, but You know, the market's always bigger than the central bank. I mean, nobody's bigger than the market. And, you know, at some point, the market says enough is enough. And, you know, not everybody wakes up at the same time and not everybody heads for the exit at the same time, but people get spooked. And, you know, I mean, just as a symptom of what we are describing, you know, the Fed, you know, have issued pronouncements with their quantitative easing tapering announcement the other day. They also said that, you know, they're going to make sure that interest rates don't rise. As long as inflation is low, they're going to make sure that interest rates don't rise. How exactly are they going to do it? The only way they've been able to do it is by buying bonds and screwing up the yield curve. But if they say that they're not going to buy any bonds, but they're going to keep interest rates low, they've got a real problem because the market says otherwise. You know, interest rates are probably a point above where they were last year. And, you know, mortgage rates are coming up and, you know, impacting the housing market already. Ultimately, the market is in charge of where interest rates are. And ultimately, lenders, creditors, are in charge of, you know, how much money they will lend the United States government. So when the government goes out to borrow money, the Fed says, oh, we have been the 800-pound gorilla in these Treasury auctions. We've been taking virtually everything. Scott, they've taken everything. I mean, last year, the fiscal year that ended last year, the Fed bought, I guess, just off the top of my head, over 100% of the deficit. So the Fed, during the course of fiscal year 2013 that ended in September, the deficit came in at, I don't know what it was, it was $690 billion or somewhere in there. The Fed bought that much, printed that much money, created that much money out of thin air, and another probably 30, 40, 50, 60 billion on top of it. So the Fed is basically the big buyer, the number one holder of U.S. Treasury debt, period, end of story. Now the Fed says, well, we're not going to have as big a presence in these auctions, you know, and the market's going to have to come in and fill in for us because the government's still going to be having a rollover debt. You know, this portfolio of government bonds, you know, some of it matures, and, you know, when it matures, it has to be rolled over. Nobody ever thinks the government debt's going to be paid back by any other expediency other than selling another bond tomorrow, so they've got to have people at the auction tomorrow to buy the new bonds, to buy the reissuances and stuff. So, you know, ultimately, this is a process that the market is in charge of, and the market, you know, has been more or less happy to buy this debt, but... You know, China has said, look, I'll tell you a story. I'll just tell you one story about how clueless these people are. It was a little over a year ago, and Barack Obama was on David Letterman's show during the presidential campaign. And David Letterman said, well, tell me, how big is the national debt? And Barack Obama, the president of the United States, said, well, I don't know precisely. And he started fumbling and so on. So Letterman tried to help him out. And he said, well, is it $10 trillion? And the president couldn't answer. And so here's the important thing to remember about this. And it's not just Democrats. I could tell you stories about Republicans and Republican presidential nominees that are utterly as clueless. But this is the single most important metric of the solvency of the United States is, you know, how much debt do we have? You know, it has to be paid back. People have to be taxed for it. How much debt do we have? And the president of the United States doesn't know. Now, he assumes a posture in these debates about whether we have too much or too little debt, can borrow more, should we raise the debt ceiling, but he doesn't know how much the debt is. And so Letterman said, well, is it $10 trillion? Well, for the record, it was $10 trillion when Obama was first elected, but at the time of the campaign last year, it was over $16 trillion, having grown by $6 trillion during Obama's watch. And he had no idea how much the debt was, so he pivoted. You know, Obama's always pivoting. He's pivoting from the Middle East to the Senkakus to get us in a war down there. Well, he pivoted on the question of how much the debt is, and he came back with that old liberal refrain that he learned at, I don't know, Columbia or Harvard or wherever he went to school and learned from his liberal professors. He said, well, the thing to know about, he deflected the question because he didn't know how much it was. He said, well, the thing that you have to know about the national debt is we owe it to ourselves.
Yep.
Of course, we never did. You know, it was always owed to people who are called bondholders, and people who had paid into Social Security on the bogus representation that they were, you know, that there was a, quote, trust fund, their words, not mine. But in any event, it shows you how clueless he is, because we no longer owe it to ourselves. We owe a third of it to foreigners, $2.5 trillion, almost $2.5 trillion, just to China and Japan. So the people that are, you know, the fiscal authorities, Republicans and Democrats alike, are utterly clueless about the nature of our problem. And frankly, you know, Yellen and Bernanke and Greenspan and the rest of them are utterly clueless as well. I mean, you remember that Bernanke told us in 2005 subprime mortgage market was contained. In 2005, it was just getting going. Alan Greenspan said, now this is how insular they are in their thought. Alan Greenspan said, well, nobody saw the housing bubble coming. And I'm here to tell you, Scott, since we have a lot of mutual friends.
Hey, I know Robert Blumen. You can't push that one over on me.
There is nobody I know with a rudimentary understanding of Austrian economics that missed it. But they are so insulated. They are so solipsistic in their little world of Keynesian magical monetary theory that they think nobody saw the mortgage bubble coming. So,
hey, I was good on the housing bubble back in 1999, 2000, when it was still the dot-com bubble. And there's only one explanation for that, of course, is I was listening to Ron Paul.
Yeah, sure.
And he was saying, oh, yeah, no, look, housing is, you know, land is probably a better bet than a dot-com bubble stock. But then again, there's a big bubble in housing, too, you know?
Well, when the housing bubble popped, did the governing classes turn to anybody who had seen it coming? Did they turn to Ron Paul and said, oh, gee, on the House floor, he described exactly how this would unfold, and it did. We ought to ask him
what to do
about it.
Hey, wait, now let me ask you this, because you talk about how interest rates have got to go up at some point. There's nothing that they can do to hold them back eventually. But then also you're talking about the national debt now at, $17 trillion, et cetera, like that. And so if I remember right, back the last time the Federal Reserve tried to contain out-of-control inflation by raising the interest rates deliberately, I guess you could say the same thing for allowing them to rise very high, what effect that has on the interest payments that the government has to make. And the I heard, isn't it like almost $1 trillion a year or three-quarters of $1 trillion a year just to pay the interest payments on the national debt? And so then if the interest rates go up that much more, then that means they could break the entire budget just paying interest payments on the national debt, never mind any of their empire building or socialism or any of that.
Sure. I mean, the prevailing rates are subnormal. If you just go back to, you know, normalize the rates over the last 12 years or so, if you just normalize it, means interest rates are roughly 3 points higher or so. I mean, you add 3 points to the cost of carrying the national debt, that adds $500 billion in interest every year to the debt. So, I mean, you know, nobody can tell you exactly step by step how this one will unfold. They can't tell you, you know, which black swan will appear. You know, I mean, I could take you back to other calamities and the burst into the bubbles. Russia defaults on its bonds and it throws long-term capital management upside down. Or somebody shoots an archduke someplace. You know, these things happen. You know,
yeah.
And it's never where people are looking. Everybody looks at Greece or Spain, and then something happens in some place like Cyprus. Everybody's looking at Iran for a war, or they're looking at Syria, and then an incident takes place, and then Senkakus or something. So it's never where everybody's looking, and it's never expected. Nobody ever says, you know, this is going to be the trigger event when the Archduke gets shot. But it's always something like that. But you know, I'm at great pains to try to tell people that it's not the triggering event. You know, the bubble won't burst because a black swan appeared on the scene sometime in 2014. The bubble will burst because it's a bubble. That's why the bubble burst, not because, you know, some foreign country has an economic calamity and it ricochets throughout the world. Yeah, you could call that the triggering event, but the bubble burst because it was a bubble.
All right, so now when they say that there are gains in the housing market and gains in the stock market, all that is just hot air?
No, I mean, it's, of course it's true. But I mean, you know, where are the gains? The, you know, all of this money, we're talking about all this money printing, all this quantitative easing, where's the money going? I mean, somebody's getting the money. Wall Street's getting the money. It's being stovepiped the direction of Wall Street and the influential money center banks. I mean, it's been stovepiped in the direction of the mortgage market. I mean, half the money is going to, you know, to mortgage-backed securities and Fannie and Freddie. They're buying their bonds. And, you know, so automobile sales, of course, you know, they move heaven and earth, and they buy $85 billion a month to force interest rates down. So, of course, automobile sales have been great and or better. You know, we had a little boomlet in housing because, you know, they were able to force interest rates down. And, of course, Wall Street's doing great. But I can tell you there is an exact perfect overlay. If you watched, you know, the rise since the recession hit in the Standard & Poor's 500, and the rise in the monetary base since the recession hit, they are virtually an exact corollary. I mean, you've never seen an overlay that tracks as well as this. They both go up at the same rate of ascent, and it's only because, you know, the creation of this money has been, you know, the wind beneath the wings of the stock market. So, yeah, the stock market's very, very high. All of these things come at the expense of somebody else. You know, there are two sides to every ledger sheet, to every balance sheet. And so all of these things are at the cost to savers. You know, savers, little old ladies in retirement that should be saving money, you know, they're forced into taking risk, higher risk than they should, you know, buying bonds in places or from people that you wouldn't think retired people would, to try to get a decent rate of return, because the Fed has manipulated interest rates down to serve one factor of the economy rather than another one. So it's a war. It's been a war on savers. It's been a war on, you know, the elderly and people that need to, you know, are on fixed incomes and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the Fed, nothing the Fed ever does is market neutral. You know, if they decide to force interest rates low, they hurt people on the other side of that equation. If they decide to raise interest rates, then they hurt other people. Rather than letting the prevailing interest rates that signal reality about the availability of money and credit in the marketplace, interest rates that show you, that convey information about what's really going on, they manipulate them, and they manipulate them down to help one faction or up to help another faction, and all it does is create distortion and malinvestment in the economy. It favors one class of Americans as against another class of Americans, and as a consequence, it is not a social lubricant by any means. It is social dynamite, and these are some of the pressures that are beginning to build in the fabric of American life.
Yeah, well, and of course, they're always describing it as on behalf of the powerless. And of course, yeah, you know, just on the basic level, right, about, you know, ultimately regular folk from farmers to office workers or anybody else who's basically a creditor, they all want inflation, especially like on their house note, right? Borrow in dollars and pay back in dimes. By the time you're done paying off what your house costs 30 years later, it's not that much anymore because all the, you know, the contract price is stuck in olden days by then. But it ignores all the other effects of the pain of inflation on people like that, such as, for example, they can never even dream of saving up and buying a house. They'd have to go ahead and get a giant debt, a 30-year debt, in order to even have one in the first place. And
well, your
never
comment,
consider otherwise.
Your comment reminds me of the old line that, you know, the federal government must love poor people because they're creating so many of them. But, you know, the wealth divide is growing like crazy in the United States. I mean, I used to keep at my fingertips, you know, great examples of it, Pew studies and Milken Institute studies and these studies and those studies, you know, about, you know, how the wealth divide is growing and income disparity in America and asset disparity and so on. I don't even do it anymore because everybody gets it. Everybody knows that the Fed has... Well, they don't know the Fed. They know that the wealthy are getting a lot wealthier, and, you know, the morons think it's because of capitalism. Well, I don't know. I've been looking everywhere, high and low, under the bed. I don't see any capitalism in this country. I see manipulation of markets by the Fed. I see them stovepiping money to their favorites. I see them moving monetary and fiscal policy to help the wealthy. So, you know, which should be no surprise. I mean, we're coming up Monday on the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve. created by the banking cartel to serve their interests to begin with, and 100 years later, that's exactly what they're doing. Who should be surprised? But, you know, the morons blame it on, you know, capitalism. They think capitalism is that caricature and monopoly, you know, the monopoly man money with the silk hat and the spats and the cane and stuff like that, when in fact we don't really have capitalism at all. We have crony corporatism in America, with the Fed doing everything to enrich them, and of course they are enriched at somebody else's. They're not enriched because they're creating great new products and services for Americans. There are people that have done that. There are people at Apple and corporations that, you know, create real things that are creating real wealth for the American people and improving life. No, Wall Street's not doing that. Wall Street's getting rich because it's bleeding off the American people, thanks to its gopher, thanks to its hay boy, thanks to its towel boy in Washington and the Mariner Eccles building.
In the that's what they call the central bank tower there.
That's the marble palatial. That's the marble palatial hall where, you know, the headquarters of the private pilots and the, you know, private chefs and the you know, the limousine drivers that ferry the muckety mucks about as they go about the business of, you know, draining the people's wealth and funneling it in the direction of the banks.
My dad has this thing on his desk. It says, "Yeah, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich?" And clearly that applies to me. And the thing of it is, you know, of course, because I always insist how smart I am all the time. No, but the point being that I really did read The Creature from Jekyll Island back in, I think, 1996 or something like that. And that's all good, sound, Misesian gold economics there. And so I understood about the business cycle back then. I knew better during the whole dot-com thing. And like I was saying, all during the housing thing. I was warning my friends in 2005 and 6, don't buy a house now, wait till the giant bubble crashes, but before the interest rates go up, and then lock in a low rate at a depressed price, you know, kind of thing. So that's the proof that I know about this stuff, and yet I never participate in it, and I never make any money off of it. And for the worst example, the one that's really getting at me now, is Bitcoins. I knew about Bitcoins because I'm a libertarian and a radio show host. People are telling me about these things the day after they were invented or something. But I never had anything to do with that. I don't ever have any money. And if I did, I wouldn't spend them investing in Bitcoins or anything. But meanwhile, I could have turned $1,000 into $50 million in the last couple of years. Something like that. If I had just decided to participate in playing the game that all of these zillionaires are playing at my expense all day anyway, right? What's wrong with that? Shouldn't I be in on one or the other of these things?
Well, I'll tell you, Scott, this is a deep philosophical question that such as we have never encountered before in our conversations, but I've known you for a long time. I've spent a lifetime in radio and know a lot of radio people, and you are among the very, very smartest. And I think that you performed a wonderful service, and I think you've created good karma for yourself. So, you know, all the transitory things that are very, very nice. I mean, look, we all like to have, you know, we all like to be wealthy and prosperous. I advocate for it every day of my life. But, you know, it's ultimately on the very last day, it probably matters a lot more what you have done to awaken the people about the needless slaughter of human beings around the globe and the policies of the people that have led us to this pass, and to try to stop the bloodshed to the extent that you can. And I think you have been very, very, you're very capable, and you've been very effective. And if you would want to switch your focus from doing that that you have done so well these many years, and turn your focus to, you know, making money on opportunities that come around, like Bitcoin, and it's like the city bus, there's always a new opportunity every day. If you miss one, it's not a problem. Next bus is coming along. If you wanted to change your life and change your focus to that, I think the loss would be all of ours.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'd change my focus just a little bit. I saw a guy on my Facebook feed said he got 40 emails from people saying, "Holy, I'm a millionaire." And I thought, yeah, you know, I could have been listening to that guy. He was just, you know, one of these evangelical Bitcoiners over the last couple of years, and sure was feeling good the last couple of weeks. Anyway, I don't know how he is today, but anyway. All right, we're over time. Thank you very much for your time. I like talking with you, Charles.
Always great to speak with you, Scott. Thank you so much.
All right, everybody, that is the great Charles Goyette. CharlesGoyette.com is his website, and check out his books. They're really great. I mean, brilliant stuff. These are the kind of books that you give to people that you love for Christmas. The Dollar Meltdown and Red, Blue, and Broke All Over. Really, I mean it. Four-star stuff. We'll be right back with Trita Parsi after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. And I realize now I probably need to go to Guitar Center and swap out some old equipment for some new. I'm not sure where the problem is, but there's a problem. Well, hopefully Trita will come out sounding okay. Trita Parsi, that is, founder of the National Iranian American Council at niacouncil.org. That's niacouncil.org. And he's got this report with Reza Marashi. And I'm sorry, one other guy. And it's called Extending Hands, Unclenching Fists, Reorienting Iran's Outlook Beyond the Nuclear Deal. Isn't that interesting? Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Trita?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Very happy to have you back on here. And
my pleasure.
So that's a very provocative title here, Reorienting Iran's Outlook Beyond the Nuclear Deal. What, in other words, what America can do to help things inside Iran get better politically, presumably for the more democratically and less Ayatollah-ly inclined. Is that about right?
Essentially, what it's saying is that if the nuclear negotiations succeed, this is going to be much bigger than about a bunch of centrifuges and enrichment and breakout capabilities. This can actually reorient Iran's entire outlook, both on regional policies as well as its internal conduct. And as a result, we have to take this out of just looking at it from a nuclear prism, and then we give suggestions on how we can do this, how we can make sure that this is successful, because it is so valuable if it actually achieves what we're hoping to.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, now recently when President Obama invoked those new sort of sub-sanctions and the Iranians quit the technical, the lower-level talks for a couple of days in protest and came back. I remember being very thankful that they were able to come back, that President Rouhani and Zarif, his foreign minister, that they have the political wind at their back in Iran right now to such a degree that they're able to do that. I don't know if it's still sort of his honeymoon period, 100 days kind of thing, like they give American presidents around here, where he gets to get away with a little bit. He's got some cushion, but it seems like the Americans are intent on making him use it all up. You talk about in the article about how it was kind of a stroke of luck. A lot of stars aligned and fell together for these reformers to be able to come to power at this time in the first place. And yet it seems like he does have quite a bit of political capital. How far do you think that will go?
More successful it is, the more forward-leaning it can be and the further it can go. And the problem with this sanctions designation, etc., I don't think it was necessarily a violation of the agreement, but the Iranians perceived it to be a violation of the spirit of the agreement. And I'm sure we would be very unhappy if they did things that are not technically violations of the agreement, but could be seen as a violation of the spirit. And there's just a limited number of these things that can happen before the process gets so weak so it collapses. So one has to think, okay, what can we do to do the opposite? What are the things we can do to strengthen this process that does not necessarily entail giving any concessions on issues of substance? But there are things we can do that could strengthen this and that could weaken those in Iran who are eager to sabotage this in order to make sure that the chances of a successful final negotiation increases. And that's what this report aims to do, and it gives several recommendations on specific projects that can be done.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so can you talk a little bit about the coalition of reformers and moderates, as you call them, as opposed to the Iranian right, that came together to make Rouhani the president in the first place, and just how strong of a case the Iranian right has in criticizing them for trying to negotiate with the great Satan at all?
Yeah, so essentially what has happened is that those who have this much, much more hardline view in Iran and who have this narrative that says that the West is always looking to weaken Iran, negotiations cannot be done because the West is cannot be trusted. I mean, you can see it's almost a mirror image of some of the hardliners here in the U.S. They dominated Iran's political elite for the last 8 years. During the Ahmadinejad years, they were very, very strong, and the other counter-narratives were essentially completely marginalized. It was very difficult to see how that counter-narrative, the more open, positive sum, as we call it, narrative, could get a foothold, mindful of how sanctions and the confrontation with Iran had kind of given an air of vindication to the hardline narrative. And this whole thing managed to change, though, as a result of the election. Because then the population went out, they voted for Rouhani. Rouhani put together this very unprecedented coalition of pragmatic conservatives, people in the center, reformists, and managed to challenge the hardline narrative and the hardliners. And this brought back into power a team of people who, more than 8 years ago, before Ahmadinejad stepped onto the scene, actually were pursuing the same policies of outreach and trying to see if there were ways to collaborate with the United States. These are the people who were behind the collaboration that the U.S. had with Iran over Afghanistan in 2001. These are the people who sent negotiations proposals to the United States in 2003, who offered to cap Iranian enrichment to 3,000 centrifuges in 2005. Today they have 19,000.
These are the very same individuals you're saying.
Sorry, these are the same individuals with the same narrative. So it's not a narrative just popped up. It's been there, but it was so marginalized right. In the last 8 years. And it became even more marginalized because of the confrontational policies of sanctions and the covert war that was taking place between the U.S. and Iran. But thanks to the elections and the choices of the population, they've been given essentially a second chance in life. And now the question is, how far can they go without the hardliners making a comeback? And the idea essentially is that they can't go very far unless they have something positive to show for. They need to be able to prove that moderation pays off. Mm-hmm. And one way, and the most important way, is to make sure that the nuclear negotiations succeed. But there's other ways as well. There can be areas of collaboration and cooperation between Iran and the United States on areas of science, areas that have nothing to do with the nuclear issue. We're not giving the Iranians anything of substance, but we can still strengthen collaboration in other areas, and by that make sure that those who actually want to move in a more constructive direction actually are proven right, that they are getting more, they're getting stronger because the entire nation is seeing that their approach is more effective.
All right, now, so, and you're arguing in the article here that the coalition of reformers, that really the people who came together to support them, it would only be a mistake to look at it from an American point of view, that it really had much to do with wanting a nuclear deal or relations with Iran at all, that it's not even about the sanctions really at all. In fact, as much as it's a stroke of luck for America that they were able to put this coalition together for domestic political reasons, it's also in a sense a stroke of luck for the pro-sanctionists who get to brag that it's only because of their sanctions that this was accomplished. But meanwhile, it's just really a lucky happenstance that, oh, good, it's our old friends from the golden offer of 2003 that George Bush should have taken the mump on.
I would say it's been a series of accidents. And if there's anyone we should give credit to, it's the Iranian people that they actually decided to go out and vote. They realized that the regime could not cheat twice in a row, that they did not have the strength to be able to pull off another 2009. In fact, if they tried to do that, they would risk the collapse of the entire region, the entire regime. So the population realized that. And then they, thanks to the coalition that existed, they all came back behind one candidate. But if the population had decided that, you know what, last time they voted, nothing happened. In fact, they got beaten up on the streets. They're not going to go and vote again. If the reformist candidate, RF, had not withdrawn and backed Rouhani, perhaps this whole thing would not have happened, because then the reformist vote would have been split in two. And then there's another very interesting fact, which is that polls show that because Iran's election system is such that there's several candidates and you have to win more than 50% in order to win the election. So most of the times it ends up being a second round because no one manages to get to 50%. So the top two candidates go to a second round. Well, what happens in those systems is that a segment of the population starts voting strategically, meaning if you're convinced that there's going to be a second round, and you're convinced that your top candidate is going to be in the second round, then you may not vote for him in the first round because that's a waste. Instead, you choose to vote for your second option in order to manufacture a runoff between your two top candidates, or because you want to make sure that a bad candidate doesn't get in. And it so just happens to be that in the poll done by Maryland University, the 24% of those who voted for Rouhani said that they actually preferred another candidate, Aliyev, the mayor of Tehran, as their top candidate. But essentially, they were so convinced he was going to be in the second round, because that's what all the polls showed, so they decided to go over and vote for Rouhani instead. And they did so to the extent that Rouhani got 50.7%, which means that he won in the first round. That gave this government in Iran now, the Rouhani government, unprecedented strength and maneuverability, because they won a landslide, essentially. And as a result, they're much more capable of going forward boldly with diplomacy than had he won in the second round.
All right, but now what about the Supreme Ayatollah Khamenei? Is he backing Rouhani 100% on this?
No, he's backing Rouhani to the extent that he feels that he has to, because he has no other choice. Right now, it's a win-win for him. He's going to back Rouhani with diplomacy, and if it works, then he's going to take credit. If it doesn't work, and particularly if the U.S. does something stupid, such as these sanctions that were just introduced today by Senator Menendez and Kirk, and by that violates the deal and the negotiations fall apart, not because of bad misconduct from Iran's side, but from the American side, then he's going to say, see, I was right. The Americans are not to be trusted, but I gave these more naive people a chance to try it. Now they've proven it to themselves and everyone else that negotiations don't work, and now we're going to go back to my preferred strategy, which is resistance, confrontation, and all of that stuff.
Right. Now, by the way, I'm sorry, but I'm so confused about this point. Who cares if the Senate tries to pass these sanctions? Obama can simply veto them or refuse to enforce them anyway. So they don't really, the Senate, and I guess the House has already passed them, right? But they don't, do they have enough votes to override his veto and force him to scotch his own deal? Really?
Actually, this does matter a lot, Scott, for several different reasons. First of all, yes, they may have enough votes to override the veto. But most importantly, at this stage, it's very unfortunate that we're still having a conversation about new sanctions.
I know it.
Because in order to make the final deal succeed, we have to lift sanctions, which means that Congress has to lift sanctions. So it's a very bad sign of our ability to live up to our end of the bargain if, instead of starting a conversation about, okay, at what point and how do we start lifting sanctions in order to get to the final deal, we're still actually in a conversation of trying to stop new sanctions from being imposed. So in that sense, it does matter gravely. And it's
in
a very
sense,
dangerous
it's already
scenario.
Working. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bad news. All right, well, so now talk a little bit, and we still got, 3-4 minutes here. So tell us a little bit about this 20-year perspective and what the Iranian regime is working toward, and you know, like you mentioned there before about the possibilities of openings for scientific exchanges on non-dual-use technologies, simple stuff. And maybe I was wondering, you know, do you have an initiative to push to educate Houston, Texas about how much money is to be made in them thar hills? Because where you can where you can establish those kinds of economic connections, you'll have a much harder time, you know, making conflict worse.
Well, so what we're pointing out is that a core element of the hardliners' narrative is that the West is trying to make sure that Iran never develops scientifically. They want to keep Iran as a third world country, and that's why Iran needs to have nuclear energy to disprove the West, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if we engage in bold, smart, and at the same time proliferation safe exchange of technology with Iranians that can range from anything to just increase the number of university exchanges to having the U.S. help resolve air pollution problems in some of Iran's worst cities, to help with an environmental disaster in northwestern Iran, in which one of the largest lakes in the Middle East is actually drying up. We're not helping their nuclear program in the slightest, but we are doing one thing. We're disproving the idea that the West is looking for Iran to consistently be underdeveloped. And that actually helps strengthen those in Iran who say, you know what, let's try to see if we can work with the West. Let's see if we can make a deal with the United States. Let's see if we can find a win-win with the United States. And that weakens those who say, no, the West cannot be trusted. We have to confront the U.S. We always have to be anti-American, et cetera, et cetera. While at the same time, it really doesn't cost the U.S. anything. It's a different thing if you said, hey, let's help the moderates by being softer on the nuclear issue. That's not what we're suggesting. We're suggesting that there should be clever measures in which we can do good things that are good for us and good for them that actually help the right people in Iran. Imagine this. Imagine if the Iranians came in and they fixed the healthcare website problems that the Obama administration had. There would be a lot of people that would be pretty ticked off that the Iranians came in and solved this, because they don't want them to take the credit for it. Well, we're suggesting that the U.S. should do a couple of clever things and get credit for it.
Yeah, makes sense. Both sides have so much to gain that you're right. Even just from the State Department's perspective, with them not having to really lose anything, they can gain a lot and gain, you know, victories to claim for themselves and all kinds of stuff. I mean, the possibilities probably are endless, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, again, this is not just about a nuclear deal. We have to have a bigger perspective.
Right.
This could end up being about making sure that if the United States doesn't gain a friend, at a minimum, it loses an enemy.
Right. Well, I think the counterfactuals right there in the campaigns of Ron Paul for president, where he would have just had a outright, here's a security guarantee, I'll never bomb you, I promise, and here's all the sanctions lifted, I'll never enforce them, and let's be friends, simple as that, the whole thing would have been over, and you know, maybe they'd have signed the additional protocol just as an extra thank you, but it wouldn't even have been necessary kind of thing, and things would have been a lot better by now. So I think anything leaning that way is you know, huge progress and certainly possible. So thanks so much for your efforts.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Trita Parsi, everybody. Hey, y'all, Scott here. The jobless rate in America keeps climbing. Food stamps and other social welfare spending continue to increase at an alarming rate. And the only thing that's kept this whole so-called recovery going at all is the Federal Reserve's inflationary printing press. Seems like 2008 might have just been a rehearsal for the financial crisis still to come. So now let me talk to you about this great video by Dr. Martin Weiss from MoneyAndMarkets.com. The video spells out how this disaster will affect you and create enormous financial opportunities if you know how to recognize a true diamond in the rough. Weiss shows when stocks have crashed and even gives the names of the biggest banks that are most likely to fail. Before you invest $1, take the time to watch this new video. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Learn from the experts how to evaluate these opportunities and start making better informed decisions that will lead to a better return on your investments. That's Dr. Martin Weiss at crisis16.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. It's the show. I'm Scott. And hey, look, I was just being honest when I said that I wish I'd played the bubbles and had zillions of dollars by now, because isn't that what we all want? That's certainly what I want. Money for nothing. You know, like, win the lottery. That kind of thing. Win the Bitcoin lottery. I don't even play the lottery. You know, I would play the lottery, but it's kind of a government scam. I mean, I know it's a private company, but it's one of those quasi-governmental programs, isn't it? You know, like fascism. And even for that jackpot, I just can't get in the habit of paying an extra tax to the state, which is what it amounts to, them and their cronies. A tax on those who are bad at math, that's what they call it. I think people who are good at math call it that. Anyway. Honestly, I would just build a skate park and go into the own a skate park business for a living, I think. If I played that, I was talking with a friend on the phone, and he said, yeah, I remember when Bitcoins were trading at 2 cents. So if I'd just taken $1,000, let's see, and he did the math because he's good at math, he said that would have been $50 million. So if you had $50 million, wouldn't you open a skate park too? And I know that skate parks are big socialist government enterprises these days, but mine would be inside with air conditioning and a hump bump and a single coping spine. I wouldn't even have to save, you know? I would just cash out my bitcoins. Well, they crashed down at $500 from a high of 1200 something, so maybe they'll crash all the way down to 2 cents again, and then I can invest wisely. I remember listening to a guy called in a radio show one day. This is years ago now. 2001 or 2 or something. No. Oh, this would have been in 2000. He said, guys, it was doing so well. I put everything I had into garden.com. And he lost everything. It had gone from $1 zillion a share to nothing. Nothing. So, easy come, easy go, right? Or easy never come in the first place, easy, don't worry about it. That, yeah, didn't lose anything after all. Okay, so now important stuff. Hey, get this. Would you believe that this is true? I might not believe it. AP poll, 57% of U.S. says, actually this is good too. This isn't the one I was thinking it was. But let's talk about this one first. 57% of U.S. says going to war in Afghanistan was the wrong thing to do. Now, I'm pretty sure that means, you know, staying. I don't know if any of them even remember that that mission was launched supposedly in the name of hunting down those behind the attack on the towers. Anybody remember that? But that's as good a numbers as we've ever had on Iraq, too. People regretting that war. I'm not saying either was more justified than the other, just that I would expect for more people to say the Afghan war was justified. But, not so much. Can you imagine that? 10 years of war for nothing. Really. 12 years of war for nothing. And I guess it won't be long before, just like the Iraq War, it'll be the other forgotten war. We got lots of forgotten wars. I have to spell them different or give them each different fonts or something. Every time we lose a war, we forget it. And you know, it's funny, isn't it, that it's John Kerry's the one with that great quotable. How do you ask the last guy to die for a mistake to be the last guy to die for a mistake? I didn't say it right, but I like my way better. How can he tell somebody, yeah, we're leaving, but at least a few more of you are going to get shot before we're done. For nothing. For everybody knows better all along anyway. Remember that Vice magazine documentary? I couldn't get the guy on the show. But it was really good. It was called This Is What Victory Looks Like, which is a quote from a lying American general. This is what victory looks like. And it's a bunch of guys over there who put themselves in an impossible situation, lamenting that fact. Being the last called to die for a mistake, if you can call it that, even a mistake, for the wrong thing to do. It's actually a better way to put it, as they put it in this poll. And I wonder if, did this make the news? Did they mention this on the top of the hour ABC radio update or anything? That major parts of the Helmand province have been handed over to the Taliban. They're not even waiting. They're going ahead and pressing their advantage while they've got it again. Again. Ain't that a hell of a thing? Wasting no time. See, what we're going to do, we're going to surge in there, we're going to give them a government in a box, and we're going to change their entire society. We're going to do our counterinsurgency surge, and we're going to kill a lot of people with a lot of Delta Force night raids. And we're going to blow up a lot of things, but by the time we leave, it's going to be just great over there. You wait and see. Remember that? Does anybody remember that? That's not the Forgotten War. That's the Forgotten War propaganda. There's a poll that they ought to ask. Are you even aware that Obama came into power and escalated the war? That there was an entire PR campaign waged to convince you that they were going to surge and it was going to work? Did you even know that? That they were bothering to tell you those stupid lies? Were you even bothering to listen at that point? All that angst about Obama's dithering. Why won't he decide to hurry up and escalate? Nobody even remembers or cares about that anymore. Which I prefer to them caring a lot and wanting to see him, follow through on the mission. But anyway, dozen years of war for nothing, and they're trying to stay. I guess we'll see if they can work out the deal to stay even longer. Another 10 years they're bargaining for now. 2024.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right. Oh, wait, I got a cough here. All right. Oh, now I got to drink some Dr. Pepper. All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. The website is scotthorton.org. And, hey, Dave the Genius came up with this. If you go to scotthorton.org/Amazon, that's all you got to do. You can just type that into your URL, no problem. Just go to scotthorton.org/Amazon, and that'll take you to Amazon by way of my button where I get a cut. So do all your Amazon shopping by way of scotthorton.org. You can just look at the right side of the page in the right-hand column there. At the top of the right-hand column is the link to Amazon. Or just go to scotthorton.org/Amazon. Isn't that cool? That's good. I gotta remember to say that all the time now. ScottHorton.org. ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right. You heard a spot there for, hey, you should hire me to give a speech. Well, Jacob Hornberger took my ad up on that. And I'm giving a talk with John Glazer at the Future Freedom Foundations Conference at the Students for Liberty, International Students for Liberty Conference in Washington, D.C. on February the 15th. And what it is I'm going to talk about foreign policy some. And then John Glazer's going to talk about libertarianism more. And it's going to be a good mix of those two subjects by me and him, who are both foreign policy libertarian guys. So, good stuff there. I've never met John in person, so that'll be fun. And, you know, I guess per capita, there must be a lot of listeners to the show on the East Coast. So if you guys can hop on a government train or whatever and cruise on over or down to Washington, D.C., that'd be cool to see there. That's at the Something or Other Hotel. Look it up at fff.org under events there. The FFF conference at the Students for Liberty conference in Washington, D.C. on February the 15th. Keep thinking of things that I want to say during it. I'm going to have to start jotting some of those down. All right. All right, now, good. I still got lots of news to cover on the show. I'm happy to have time to do so. I don't always have a chance to do so. This kind of cuts right to the heart of American foreign policy, doesn't it? And not just because it's at foreignpolicy.com. Senate panel approves bill keeping aid flowing to military governments. So you already know what it's about, right? Egypt. And for that matter, Mali. Sometimes it's problematic when our government favors military dictatorship, and yet the rules are written around this pretension that our government's policy prefers democracy around the world, which they certainly do not, unless that democracy happens to be interested in leaning their way. Just incidental from here to there. So, obviously, they've got a huge problem in Egypt, an embarrassing problem in Egypt. Well, geez, we supported their sock puppet torture dictator, their military dictatorship, for 30 years. But then the people, left, right, and everybody in Egypt came together and overthrew that dictator, Hosni Mubarak, back almost 3 years ago now. So then what happened is that the Americans had the military overthrow the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood that had replaced him. And they had to pretend that they didn't. Actually, see, I don't know 100% for a fact that, and it's kind of disputed among the different experts on my show, but Eric Margolis says that, listen, kid, if the Egyptian government, if the Egyptian military overthrows their president, They did it. They were working hip to hip, hand in glove with the Pentagon. Simple as that. The Egyptian military is the Pentagon. I don't think I'm overstating Margulies' case on the show. And, I'm going to defer to him on that one. There are some indications that, the Saudis, I don't really see the discrepancy between Saudi and American policy on most of this stuff. But at least the stunt was that the law forbids America, Obama, from giving military aid and cooperating in military exercises with the Egyptian military dictatorship because they had overthrown a democratically elected government. Yeah, but what if the Americans don't like the democratically elected government and they do like the military dictatorship? Well, in that case, we want to keep giving them weapons. And in that case, it becomes embarrassing that we can't keep giving them weapons just because of that stupid rule that you can't give them weapons if the military overthrows the democratically elected government somewhere. So let's get rid of that rule. Let's go ahead and kill the pretension. That way, when we come into such obvious conflict with it, we won't have to suffer the embarrassment of having it mentioned on the news hour or whatever. I guess. I don't know what other consequence they have to suffer. But there you go. We like military dictatorships, cry the Republicans and the Democrats. They're flunkies. Senate panel approves bill to keep aid flowing to military governments. And then I thought this was hilarious. Also from foreignpolicy.com, Boeing just lost a huge defense contract thanks to Ed Snowden. And they're not being ironic about that. Well, good. Screw Boeing. That's my foreign policy. They wanted to sell a bunch of F-18s to Brazil. The Brazilians have decided that they want to buy these fighter jets, some comparable fighter jets, from the Swedes instead. And the thing is, they're cheaper, but what really killed the deal, according to this article, according to Brazilian sources, is the politics of the Snowden revelations. There's just no way they could give the deal to Boeing under current circumstances. We talked on the show the other day a little bit, too, with Marcy, about the consequences for IBM and the huge hit that they've taken. They're being sued over it. That was just my first clue to what a huge hit they've taken, although seems like any of us could have guessed. But the same goes for Facebook, and the same goes for Amazon, same goes for Microsoft, same goes for all the biggest American tech brands and their phone services as well. Private people and governments to various degrees throughout the world are all diversifying out of American information technology. You know, before they were able to kind of cognitive dissonance it away a little bit, you know. Everybody knows that they could be watching you, but are they really watching you? And Snowden confirmed that, yep, they're watching you all. And so people are acting on it. People and governments, too, are acting on it and diversifying out of American tech. And that goes for planes and that goes for a lot more. But screw the militarists, especially. You know, if you even just consider, even if you're not a libertarian, or if you're a libertarian anarchist, then be a sloppy minarchist with me for a minute. But if you think about even having a bare bones nation state that where the government is in charge, at least, of maintaining enough military force to prevent any other government from replacing it, something like that, night watchman state theory or whatever, minarchist state theory, then wouldn't it make sense that the defense contractors would have to operate on a no profit whatsoever from their defense sector basis, that the American country would all just expect of them that whatever American manufacturers, that if the government needs these supplies for the military, that they're willing to do it for an at-cost basis, not cost-plus, for at-cost, that no one would think in a decent, fair, honest, above-board constitutional-type society that it would be tolerable to have this outrageous conflict of interest where, companies are become just completely turned around one customer, the military, and have such a strong interest in keeping the military going. And now, you know, ultimately, as long as they're pulling ore out of the ground and weapons are made of metal, there's going to be private interests involved all the way up and down the chain. But wouldn't you try to limit it? Wouldn't you have it set where every incentive structure is made as possible to prevent a permanent sector of the economy that is just based around selling weapons to this and other governments? And, I mean, this foreign policy post here, this blog entry at foreignpolicy.com, thanks a lot, Ed Snowden, is just the internalization of this corruption in the minds of people to such a degree they expect that we would agree with this, just hands down, without thinking about it, that of course we take this personally as a hit against us as a country, as a society, as a people, that Boeing lost a contract and therefore our economy, quote unquote, took this hit. When of course, you know, if you're just being a decent person and you don't have a vested interest, then you want to see the Brazilian government shoot missiles at as few people as possible at all times, right? Just as your basic default position. Someone would have to sell you a really good reason otherwise why the Brazilian government needs to shoot missiles at people, right? The burden's not on them. The burden is not on those who would lobby to sell them missile shooter machines, you know, for shooting missiles at people with. And anyway, even if you take this personally somehow, then tough. Edward Snowden did what he had to do. And even the judge says what he revealed to Glenn Greenwald and therefore the world was an unconstitutional program violating your natural rights that the Constitution forbids your government from encroaching on. Collecting all of our metadata. I'll show you metadata, said the judge. Ipso facto, Snowden vindicated even by the state itself. And all the revelations that keep coming out are things that make Google executives and Google, the bosses of the tech departments cuss out loud to the Washington Post in horrific cussing swear words. What they can't believe. Are you kidding me? They've been doing what to us? Say the guys who administer Google servers. About how the government has been violating the law and running the law, going outside America in order to break into their servers, in order to steal everything domestic that they're not allowed to get any other way. And these things are huge. There's, in fact, if you go to EFF.org or if you go to America.AlJazeera.com, they both have great archives. If you Google search those, you can find them. Where they have full, especially EFF.org, I think, has it all in one page, really, for you. Although the Al Jazeera thing, they got great graphics, so whichever you prefer. But their timelines, complete timelines of all of the Snowden revelations, all of the news stories from all the different sources, all hot linked back to the original there, and including all of the documents, too. All of it there at EFF.org. You can read all that. And this stuff is huge. And so even if this costs Boeing some 737 sales to Brazil, which is a hit to Washington State civilians who are, you know, building subsidized aircraft, whatever. Anyway, if it did cut some legitimate sales, if it's hurt brand USA in any sense, then that's just tough. And especially that's just tough for the executives and the shareholders who are paying the price when they're the only ones in America who have any influence at all. They're the only ones in the world who could possibly tell, for example, Charles Schumer to shut up with the warmongering all the time. Right? they're the only ones who could insist that American capitalism be based on, you know, making stuff and selling it instead of just these quasi-socialist programs like the military, these make-work programs and military-industrial complex welfareism. But they don't. They just try to get on board the gravy train as much as they can because they're pigs for the most part. So, you know, hey, what are you going to do? Change the world? Try marketing to the army. It's incredibly easy. You just pay them dimes and they pay you dollars. It's awesome. That's the structure of the America's deformation there. But anyway, thanks a lot, Ed Snowden, for costing Boeing's Weapon of Death and Destruction Department and their shareholders a little bit of money. They're really mad at you over there at Foreign Policy. I say thanks only without the snark. And then there's the poll here. Where's the poll on... that's not it. Well, shoot. Oh, it was on antiwar.com here somewhere. Record high in U.S. say big government is the greatest threat. Now 72% say that big government is a greater threat than big business or big labor. Well, you're right. That's not an opinion. That's an objective scientific fact. They are the enemy of the American people. They're like a giant tick sucking your blood, inflating your savings away, setting you up with a giant boom for the next big bust, and, you know, maybe getting you killed in a terrorist attack or your son killed occupying somebody's country where he's got no business. And enforcing a bunch of bad laws on a bunch of good people. That's what they are. Simple as that. So good. The American people are finally catching on. This is where Wendy McElroy had that great article a few weeks back about how this is why the crackdowns and the escalation of police brutality across the board is because they know that people don't believe in them anymore. So all they got left after that is fear. Because they'll be damned if they're going to let themselves just be repealed and leave us alone. And the American people, at least so far, can't seem to get their head together about exactly what the problem is. It's the empire. The empire makes the federal government important. No empire, then the entire momentum is for decentralization, because that has more to do with how people operate in real life anyway. It is in wartime that the state truly comes into its own, teaches Professor Murray Rothbard. Teaches James Madison, the guy that wrote the Constitution and saddled us with this military in the first place. But anyway, so there you go. Look at the polls. Pretty impressive. From the Gallup poll here, galluppoll.com. Record high in U.S. say big government greatest threat. And, of course, in order of the empire, the domestic homeland security state, the drug war, of course, all the domestic surveillance goes along with both of those, really. And all of the domestic militarization of the state and local and federal police as well, massive incarceration rates and all that mostly is wrapped up with the drug war. And then, of course, you know, there's, after that, the cruelty of the criminal justice system and all of that is the distortion in the economy from the federal government's welfare toward previously mentioned military-industrial complex firms, as well, of course, as the big pharmaceutical companies and the big agribusiness firms and, of course, the banks that service the debt. And whatever other, the unions, of course, and big business are all corrupt interests. You know, like government employees have the right to their job. And they're supposedly servants of the rest of us. Don't ever make them prove that. That's just the PR. But anyway, so the other thing I got to say about this is the down note, which is that this is only because Democrats are in power. And Republicans all, well, not all, but many Republicans like to pretend that they care at all about human liberty or decency, for that matter, honesty in any respect, when Democrats are in power. Oh, they'll wax on about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution or whatever, sound positively libertarian. Yeah, until Jeb comes. And then we know how you are with your, you know, subservience and obedience in your echo chamber of power. Make Chris Matthews look like a honest critic of government compared to the right wingers when their guy isn't running things. And even if it's not their guy, right? Even if it's George Bush's son, they'll still go for it. George Bush's son, huh? All right, fine. All hail. So, I think, just wait till Jeb comes and we'll see what the numbers say. Especially if on Jeb Bush's watch there's a massive failure, like a huge attack that kills thousands of people, that all of his security services fail in every way to prevent. Then they'll give him a 90% approval rating and carte blanche to kill anyone in the world he wants, including by torturing them to death if he wants to. That's what conservatives will do. They'll rally around George Bush's son to any degree. In fact, if George Bush Jr. had decided that he was just going to drop an H-bomb on Baghdad or on Tehran, they'd have gone along with that. Doesn't matter that they had nothing to do with September 11th at all. But American conservatives, yeah. Thank goodness that, I don't know, Stephen Hadley or somebody was up there to talk him out of it. I don't know. Who could it have been? Not Hadley. All right. Russian ICBMs. There's a story here about how the Russians are embarking on a whole new campaign. They're going to spend billions of dollars revamping all of their three-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I say this is all Washington's fault. And of course, it's all the Kremlin's fault, too. But it's especially all Washington's fault. America has every advantage in this. And America is the one really determined to hold the whole world hostage with our hydrogen bombs and the threat of a first strike and all of that. And as horrible, let's pretend that Putin is 1,000 times more horrible than I say. And I say he's pretty horrible. But even if all of that is true, still, the burden is on the Americans to try to do everything they can to end the H-bomb standoff with Moscow. And they just won't do it. They have no interest in it whatsoever. When they passed the latest version of the START Treaty, they actually were just making everything worse. They attached so many riders onto the thing to promise to revamp America's nukes and to expand facilities and, you know, we need a new kind of nuke so that they have to make a whole new facility in order to make the new kind of nuke and all this military-industrial complex stuff, even in the nuclear weapons industry. They built all that into the START Treaty meant to limit these things. Meanwhile, you know, it was Robert Gates, speaking of George Bush Sr., it was Robert Gates as Bush Jr.'s Secretary of Defense, or maybe it was after Obama inherited him, but Obama inherited him and kept him for a while. His team, the Office of Secretary of Defense, not just some room in the Pentagon came up with this, but the Office of the Secretary of Defense put out a thing written by Air Force generals saying we only need 14 nukes to hold the whole world hostage, to make sure that no one would dare attack us ever because we can vaporize their capital city or we can, you know, take out the bulk of their military forces in an afternoon, and that'll be it. We'll have all the deterrent we need without the ability to destroy all of civilization. It seems like decent compromise to make with people holding a bunch of H-bombs. Like, maybe if we could insist on that. It's their idea. Hey, we only want, can we keep 14, please? And the American people are like, yeah, keep 3,000. What do we care? The American establishment says, we don't even know how many you got. Don't, not worried about it. I say that that's a problem. And in fact, I think a headline like this, Russia to spend billions on new ICBMs, ought to be all it takes to get the American people to say, hey, Obama, we got a thing we want you to do. A nuclear deal with Russia, a real one. And the more you tell the Republicans and the hawkish Democrats to shut up about it, the better. The more we'll like you. Go over there and do like Reagan wanted to do at Reykjavik and make the deal and abolish the nuclear stockpiles. At that point, it's just in the asking to get the rest of our allies to go along. It won't be hard. Even the Pakistanis and the Indians, even the Israelis could be made to go along if the Americans would lead the way on that. So, yeah, anyway, more pie in the sky on the show tomorrow. Thanks, everybody, for listening.